All right, welcome back to our study of Ecclesiastes, and we are in chapter 8 today. If you remember back to chapter 7 last week and the week before, we kind of looked at what it looked like to live a balanced life, right, in the face of a cursed and confusing world. And Solomon encouraged us not to be too wise and not to be too wicked and kind of to balance our expectations of unraveling Hevel or really not having this view of turning away from wisdom and frustration because it's not working. And he kind of testified last week of his own personal pursuit of Lady Wisdom as he sought to really understand and grasp what she was all about. And then how he was frustrated by his inability to do so because wisdom was too deep and too wide, too far away. And so this week we really are continuing in some of the same ideas as Solomon continues to kind of pull back the curtain on how wisdom interacts with us in our daily lives and what the intent of wisdom is. And this week there's kind of two primary sections. The first deals with the relationship between, well, they both kind of do, but it's the relationship between wisdom and authority. How we should respond with wisdom to both human authority in front of us, that's kind of section one, and then also why we should trust a divine authority as well. So wisdom helps us kind of live well underneath a human authority and our government. Even if it's corrupt and broken, wisdom still applies. And it kind of teaches us also to live well in our place beneath divine authority as well. So we'll go ahead and read through at least the first section of chapter 8. Well, let's read through all of chapter 8. That's what we're going to cover today is 8 all the way through. And so we'll go ahead and read through that once so you have a little bit of a sense of where we're going. And then we'll come back to the beginning. So he says, "Who is like the wise? And who knows the interpretation of a thing? A wise man's or a man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed. I say, keep the king's command because of God's oath to him. Be not hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand in an evil cause, for he does whatever he pleases. For the word of the king is supreme, and who may say to him, 'What are you doing?' Whoever keeps a command will know no evil thing, and the wise heart will know the proper time and the just way. For there is a time and a way for everything, though man's trouble lies heavy on him. For he does not know what is to be. For who can tell him how it will be? No man has power to retain the spirit or power over the day of death. There is no discharge from war, nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. All this I observed while applying my heart to all that is done under the sun, when man had power over man to his hurt. Then I saw the wicked buried. They used to go in and out of the holy place and were praised in the city where they had done such things. This also is vanity. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily, the heart of the children of man is fully set to do evil. Although a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God, because they fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked. Neither will he prolong his days like a shadow, because he does not fear before God. There is a vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. And there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say that this also is vanity. And I commend joy, for man has nothing better under the sun but to eat and drink and be joyful, for this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, how neither day nor night do one's eyes sleep. Then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. Okay, there's a lot to cover here, and this is probably one of the most difficult, well, it contains within it, this passage contains within it some of the most difficult verses in Hebrew, and some of the most hotly debated because they're a little bit mysterious what they mean. And there's quite a few of them that actually take a slightly different word or interpretation than the ESV does. Sometimes the New King James takes, I think, a little bit better approach. Other times, neither of them, I think, quite catch what he's saying. But it's kind of difficult. It's weird. So we're in for a little bit of an interesting morning as we kind of work through some of these interpretations in Ecclesiastes. But he starts out for us in verses 1 and 2 by kind of describing some of these. It's almost like two proverbs, sort of as an introduction. Verse 1. Who is like the wise? First question. And he's intending a comparison. He's actually commending the wise. Okay, he's actually saying, like, who compares to the sage? Like, who is it? He's exalting this wise person, giving them kind of this benefit. He's saying that there is something to them that is better, right? Who's like these wise people? And who knows the interpretation of a thing? Well, the wise man does, right? The wise man is able to interpret things that other people perhaps cannot, right? Knowing how to act in a particular situation is the most relevant aspect of the expertise of a wise person. Right? And that's what Solomon's kind of been seeking to discover is, what is good and what is bad in a particular situation? What's wise to do? What's foolish to do? What is right and what is wrong? And wisdom involves kind of knowing what's fitting within a particular situation. And so Solomon's intent here is in this kind of introductory section is to fortify his arguments for the benefits of wisdom, but then later on he'll also continue to fortify his arguments against or about the limitations of wisdom. Wisdom, as we know, is not omniscient, right? It doesn't make you omniscient. It solves a lot of riddles and makes sense of a lot of confusion, and it helps you avoid this pit of folly and knowing lady folly, and it should be valued for that, right? He's sort of commending wisdom at the beginning here. Who's like the wise, and who knows the interpretation of a thing? Well, the wise man does, right? And then he says in proverbial form, a man's wisdom makes his face shine and the hardness of his face is changed. So there's two kind of unique phrases there to this proverb. The man's wisdom makes his face shine is the first one. That's kind of a common Old Testament idiom for, it's often used to communicate like God's gracious actions toward his people that result in their peace or their confidence or their stability. So a wise man's face is like one of graciousness, right? He's in similar fashion to God, the way that God made his people's face shine. So a wise man's face is positive. It is gracious. It is peaceful toward other people. And then the second one is a little bit more difficult. He says, and the hardness of his face is changed. Now that hardness of his face, we could kind of take as either a negative or a positive. Okay, so this is our first difficulty. The hardness of his face is changed. Now, if we took it negatively, then we would say that this man, by wisdom, is changed from someone who's kind of stone-faced or hard-nosed or just difficult. He's kind of maybe even impudent, like he's just bold in his arrogance. His face is changed. It's like softened almost to be a more gracious kind of person. That would be how we would take it if we took hardness as a negative thing, as a bad thing. If we took it positively, then you could also take this as like the idea of confidence or strength, right? The hardness, the strength, it grows or is changed. The hardness of his face is changed. So you would say that sometimes wisdom makes your confidence or your assurance grow. We've observed before that kind of, that's one of like the benefits of wisdom, right? Is to be able to see the world a little bit more clearly. It's like light to your path. It illuminates the world and helps you see it as it really is. And when you see the world as it really is, it helps you have confidence in discerning wisdom, right? The best decisions to make. So it could be that he's saying that man's wisdom makes him more gracious and more confident in his life. I don't know that there's necessarily a stronger argument for either one, and I think they both bring you to truth and reality. And it doesn't have much of an interpretive impact on the rest of the text either. So he's just arguing for the benefits still of wisdom. And then he jumps right in verse 2, to his kind of the main point, the main point of the first half of chapter 8. And that is the relationship between men and kings, right? How to live with wisdom in the face of your government. And he says this, I say, here's an imperative, keep the king's command. Why? Because of God's oath to him. So first and foremost, he argues that wisdom encourages you toward obedience of your government. Now, why is that? Well, he says here, and this is another, we're already to another one of the difficult interpretive texts. So he says, because of God's oath to him. Now, there's probably three ways that we could take this, and each has a bit of an argument behind it. The first, this has to do with like the syntax of the grammar, like how is it actually functioning, particularly this word, because, right? So it says, we could take that as, well, let's see. First, I need to say, like, obviously we're looking at the ESV translation, so we're already looking at one of the three interpretations. So the words quite woodenly in Hebrew are, and upon the cause of the oath of God. So, and upon the cause of the oath of God. So we have God's oath, and we have to kind of maneuver around like what's happening here. We could be that we take it as manner or in the same way. So in the same way that you would keep an oath to God, like if you made this promise to God, then in the same way you should keep the king's command. So kind of take it very seriously. Approach it soberly. Don't be kind of messing around with keeping the king's command, but take it seriously. And then there's two ways that we could take it causally. So the first one's manner. The second one would be cause. First could be because of God's oath to him, which is obviously what we have in front of us here. That would be saying that God has set the king up, right? God's the one that's in control of governments. He's the one that's placed him there. And there's some sort of like commitment that God's made to the king. So in breaking the king's commandment, you've also like breached your, you kind of crossed the line as far as what God's commanded this king to do, or like God's commitment to the king. If you break your commitment to the king, then you've kind of broken God's command as well. Is kind of how that could be taken. And then the third one, I think, is probably the most likely because of your oath to God. So we're talking probably about someone who is in the presence of the king. We're talking probably about someone who's working in the government and has this relationship probably in the king's court. And this person has taken an oath, right, to serve the king, to be loyal to him. And so I think probably what he's saying is because of your oath to God, the man serving the king has sworn an oath before God to do so. Therefore, his allegiance lies with the king. I think it's probably that or the, and I think that's the New King James, the way the New King James reads. It's probably that or the first one, that because you just need to take this very seriously, I think is what he's trying to get to, rather than saying that there's some promise that God has made to the king that should motivate us to keep the king's command. So needless to say, kind of the important part, the thrust of the command here is to be obedient to your authorities. And we'll work this out a little bit at the end of this section. Because our government obviously looks very differently than a monarchy, but I think there's still some helpful parallels. So then he says in verse 3, do not be hasty to go from his presence. We're already to another difficult interpretive line. So this be hasty, is probably not the best way to translate the word. Do not, which would say, okay, so there's two ways of saying this. One is do not leave his presence hastily, right? Like, don't run from the king's presence. If you don't like something that he's doing, don't leave in a huff, right? Like, stick around. Don't immediately, like, flee from his presence before you've heard everything that he has to say. Maybe if he's giving you an instruction, don't, like, leave before he's done. Okay, so that those are some ways to take this. But I think that probably a more accurate, not just helpful, but accurate word would be like terrified. Do not be terrified in the king's presence. Instead, be willing to leave. Now, there's the way that the Hebrew's working here. Okay, so there's a lot of different stems in which Hebrew verbs can show up. And the stems kind of communicate like the grammatical voice, which is like whether it's active or passive or something like that. And they kind of point you a certain direction. And so when this Hebrew word for hasty in our ESV is used in the stem in which it's found here, which is the Nephal stem, then there is only one other time potentially that it means hasty. The most common way to interpret it in this stem is disturbed or dismayed or terrified, frightened. It's kind of the primary way that you would look at it. Now, there's a possibility, some, like the most famous lexicon, which is like an assembly of definitions of words in that time. The most famous lexicon does include hasty as an option, but the only two verses that it lists as possibilities for that are this one and one other one in Proverbs. So it's much more commonly meant to be terrified. And this word is used two other times in Ecclesiastes in a different stem to mean hasty. So why would he change stems and continue with that same meaning? It's kind of the main argument behind why you would go with terrified. So if you do that, then you have don't be terrified in the king's presence. Instead, be willing to leave. Right? Be willing to walk away. So it kind of, he's saying like, be calm, be confident. It actually, since we've been working through Psalm 62, it kind of reminds me of one of the verses in Psalm 62 where he's being attacked by other people, but he just takes solace in the fact that he says, on God rests my salvation and my glory. My mighty rock, my refuge is God. And he just says, whatever the king does, whatever my enemies do, whatever anybody does, I don't need to be afraid. Like, I can be calm and confident in wisdom, in knowing and having a clear view of reality. And then I think he's also saying, don't be afraid to walk out at the right time, right? There's a time to be present and interact and work through even with the king as he's seeking counsel, probably from a wise man, of what to do. But there's a time to say, you know, probably enough discussion is enough. I'm going to let you make your decision. And he doesn't seek to kind of continue impacting or influencing what the king is going to do. And he kind of works that out in the second. He says, don't take your stand in an evil cause. Why? Because the king's going to do whatever he wants. The king's going to do what he pleases. So this evil matter is probably just like a bad idea or counsel that the king took poorly, a suggestion that the king dislikes. Like, don't take your stand there, right? You have to kind of choose your battles and be willing to say, I'm going to make a stand here. I'm not going to make a stand here. And he says, most often, don't make a stand. If the king doesn't like it, don't push him on it. The situation obviously is unpleasant, but don't insist that what you're saying is right and that he must listen or else, right? Like, not every battle is really worth fighting. So rather than argue with the king, just go quietly. Why is that? Again, the end of verse 3. Because the king's going to do what the king wants to do. The king's going to do what he pleases. And especially in this time or in this governmental system, the word of the king is supreme. So whatever he says goes. Like, in most of the ancient world, the king wasn't even subject to the law, right? His words were the law. Whatever he said went. And so wisdom says, don't get on his bad side. Wisdom says don't be pushing negatively the guy who at a whim could condemn you to death. That wouldn't be a wise way to live, right? So you need to kind of exercise wisdom. It's almost like this dance. Like you need to know when to say something. You need to know when to not say something. And demanding your way, that your way is wise, even if it is the best course of action, saying, what are you doing? Like pushing the king and demanding that he listen to you or do what you're suggesting that he does would be a foolish way to proceed. So it's certainly historically contextual, right? We don't live quite in this situation anymore. And certainly our leaders are responsible to other leaders, right? But ultimately, there's a couple things I think we want to walk away with from these first four verses. And that would be, it's perhaps even practically the king wasn't subject to someone else in this time. But kings have always been subject to someone. Kings have always been subject to their accountability to God, right? God's the one that sets them up and takes them down. And whether they pursue him or honor him in the way that they lead, or even whether they recognize that they're accountable to him or not, they are, right? And abusing that power is a serious offense, not only to those that you're offending or that you're oppressing, but also to God. So rulers will be held accountable by God himself. So a wise king would listen to counsel, right? We've seen that even before. But a wise counselor knows when to push and when to hold back. And then just to kind of contrast this a little bit with our governmental system, right? We've moderated some of this abuse of authority, you know, with voting or with kind of checks and balances within the system. Certainly we haven't eliminated corruption by any means, right? We're still living life under the sun and it's still oppressive. But the system's not at the whim of one, right? It's not one person, it's not tyrannical, at least here in our governmental system. One person's word is not law. We've sought to kind of distribute that voice amongst many people. And that has, I think, helped. But that doesn't mean we don't need to exercise these same principles of wisdom. And the first one, and the main one in this section, is keep the king's command, right? Be obedient to your authority. Let's continue on. He says, whoever keeps a command will know no evil thing, and the wise heart will know the proper time and the just way. Now, there's a question here at the beginning of verse 5. Whoever keeps a command, well, whose command are we talking about? Are we talking about the king's command or obeying God's command, like God's laws? I think I'd lean towards the first, that he's talking but still about obedience to a king. But it could be both. Like in Proverbs 24, verses 21 and 22, Solomon says, my son, fear the Lord and the king, and do not join with those who do otherwise, or for those that are like disobeying the laws of the king and God. For disaster will arise suddenly from them, and who knows the ruin that will come from them both. Okay, so destruction and ruin follow people who disobey both the king's law and God's law, both. And sometimes they can be the same thing. Like sometimes obedience to God and the king are in harmony. It's one and the same. Not always. And therein lies kind of more discernment and more wisdom for how to interact with those situations. But very often, those two are in harmony. And when you do so, right, he says kind of the result is that you know no evil thing, or you're kind of protected from a lot of, especially as we're talking historically, contextually, you're protected from the whim of the king against you, right? Obey him, he's happy with you. And that kind of follows the same proverbial things that are true about obeying God too, right? Obey God, blessing, disobedience is cursing. And then he goes on to say another thing about wisdom, right? That the wise heart knows the proper time and the just way. It's possible, even in this whole situation where you have a wise counselor speaking to what I think he's going to draw out is actually a kind of a corrupt king. And it's possible for you to know what is better, right? This kind of harkens back to the beginning of chapter 3, where he says, for everything, there is a time and a season. There's a purpose for it under heaven. And our part of our responsibility, our secondary responsibility, is to discern those times. Our first is to fear God because of them, because there are things that are beyond us. And our second is to discern them as best that we can. So it's possible that someone would have a better answer than what the king is doing. Like, they have the ability to know what is right, right? The proper time and the just way. The wise heart has discovered these things. But still, probably better to obey than to push the agenda. So wisdom in the presence of human authority. It involves both respect and the freedom to offer counsel. So wisdom encourages you to support, not oppose, the authority. Use wisdom, he's kind of saying, use the benefits of it to survive in kind of a, like, in a dangerous and an unjust, even a corrupt world. Daniel is a great example of this in the Old Testament. If you kind of look at how he handled being thrown into a situation where he was the wise counselor to a corrupt king. And how did he live? Well, he wasn't afraid of the government, even a corrupt one, right? He did what he knew he needed to do before God. So he wasn't afraid, which kind of goes back to that principle at the beginning of verse 3, right? Don't be terrified in his presence. But then secondly, Daniel obeyed the king, right? Until it crossed the line of his obedience to God, he always did what the king wanted him to do, or wisely, carefully offered another solution to the king, right? So he obeyed the king, even a corrupt one. And then he also supported his leadership, even when he had better solutions, right? You kind of look even at the end of his life, and he counseled a variety of kings. And there were times that he just came in and said, well, the result is actually going to be your destruction. That's what we're finding out here. But he just continued being himself a wise man before God, and let God work out the situation with the kings, right? Bring them up and take them down. So I think kind of looking back to Daniel helps us to understand even what 1 through 5 would be all about. So then this takes us right to verse 6. Okay, so for there is a time and a way for everything, although man's trouble lies heavy on him. So this first part echoes verse 5. There's a time and a way for everything, right? The proper time and the just way, even though man's trouble lies heavy on him. And I think this is again talking about the inability of man to know, right? Beginning of verse 7, for he does not know what is to be, for who can tell him how it will be? So the trouble that is heavy upon man is his inability to see the future. It's still the hevel that's kind of this smoke screen in front of him, shielding him from understanding full wisdom, of having answers to all the questions that he wants. So there is a right time and a way, but our inability to know things and to discern the future gets in the way sometimes of the clarity of our wisdom. What do we know, right? Very little. And I think that that's part of where this obedience to the king and to God helps clarify our responsibility. That because we can't be absolutely certain of the future, sometimes even wise men are wrong, and it's better to just obey the rulers that God's placed in front of you. And in that, there's kind of a net of security, perhaps not circumstantially, but at least standing before God. You can say, I did what I believed was right, right? I obeyed my authorities. Even when I thought there was a different way that would be better, right? A proper time and a just way that I discovered. This is very applicable to us today, right? And I'll say this even for the recording, though, that we won't always be in the middle of a pandemic, so this will probably be dated eventually. But this is helpful for us as far as handling and responding well to this whole COVID-19 situation. Who knows what's best? Who knows the future? None of us, right? None of us actually know what's going to happen with these things. However, God has set in place rulers above us that have the responsibility of making decisions. Some people have the opportunity to counsel them. Others do not. And all of us have the opportunity to live wisely in the middle of this circumstance, which is necessarily obedience to the king, right? Until the king crosses God's law, we have every responsibility to obey him. And that will go better for us. That's the wise way to live. The wise way to live is to submit to the authority. And so that's why we're doing what we're doing. Who knows what's best? Both sides are confident, right? More lockdown, more freedom. Who knows which one's actually going to be the right solution? We don't know. But leaders have had to make the decisions, and we'll only be able to find out the results of the one direction that we ended up going. This is part of why we exercise faith in the sovereignty of God, right? Because we are unable. We are limited. And that's what verse 8 is actually telling us about. Verse 8 goes and it gives us four examples of our inability, four examples of things that we cannot control. And he says, so let's just look at these four. One, no man has power to retain the Spirit. Or the Spirit is the same word for wind, which probably more likely points back to his division markers in the first half of the book, where he said that it's like shepherding the wind, right? It's an impossibility. No one has the ability to retain the wind or to control it. It goes where it wants to go. You also don't have power over the day of death. Life and death are in God's hands, not yours, right? He has authority there. There's no discharge from war. It's kind of a difficult, complicated one. It probably is just more literal, like one of two things. Once you're engaged in war, you can't turn back, right? Like once you're there, there's no retreat. You're in the middle of this swarm of people running forward and you have no control over it. You've got to run forward as well. Or it could mean there were many people that would kind of pay someone else to go and stand in their place in battle. And you may be saying you don't have the opportunity to do that. There's no discharge from war. You have to go kind of be a part of life. There's no escaping the difficulties here. And then the final one is that nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. You can't outrun the consequences of sin, right? It looks like you can often in life. But eventually wickedness betrays everyone who trusted in it. There's another great example from Psalm 62, right? Trusting in robbery is like vain hope. It's something you put your trust in, but eventually it's going to betray you because it doesn't actually care for you. So it's possible to live a full life. It's possible to die even apparently unscathed by wickedness. But at the end of the day, wickedness will not deliver you. So kind of the main point of what he's saying here in these four examples is that wisdom teaches you to actually embrace your limitations, right? In order to understand reality, you have to understand your inability. So you know your role and you know the role of wisdom in your life. For the sake of time, we got to keep moving. We could spend more time in verse 8. But then this last verse 9 wraps up this section, this final observation. Solomon observes while he's in the midst of applying his heart to everything that's done here under the sun, right? This great experiment that he's doing. He observes that it's all happening when man had power over man to his hurt. So the sphere of his evaluation is still the cursed world. It's still oppression filled. He's pointing back now to the king, right? That the king could be wicked. The king might be oppressive. And that doesn't change the role of wisdom in your life and how you should respond. So the wise person knows he knows the interpretation of a matter, right? He knows how to answer. He knows what the right way and the right season of something is. But in the context of absolute power, right? Or like the power of the king, the only wise thing to do seems to be like to acquiesce to it. Even though we know and we see, yes, Kings oppress other people. Yes, kings are wicked. Furthermore, we don't know the future, right? Those are kind of the main tenets of this first half. Now, we got to move quickly, so I spent even more time on that probably than we should have. So verse 10, he transitions, right? New topic. Then I saw. That's very common in the first half of the book. It's kind of an introductory thing to another topic that Solomon wants to discuss. So then he saw this, the wicked buried. They used to go in and out of the holy place and were praised in the city where they had done such things. This also is vanity. Okay, so he's observed another thing that is hevel. He's observed another thing that is vanity, and that is that you have wicked people who are buried, and they were the ones that used to go in and out of the temple. They were the ones that used to worship, and they were hypocrites. And this is another one that we could really go into. This word praised is, again, not the best way to say it. This is arguably the most, some people have said the most difficult verse in Ecclesiastes based on the Hebrew. So this word is actually in the MT, forgotten. And they were forgotten in the city because they had done such things, which on its face might not quite make sense. Like if they were forgotten, isn't that a good thing? So some people add the word, the adverb just. So like people were forgotten in the city who had acted justly. So like the wicked were buried and then the people that were just were forgotten. Probably not the best idea. Solution two would be to take the Septuagint's translation. The Septuagint was the one that translated it, praise, which is the difference of the shape of one of the letters in Hebrew. So they probably just misread it and wrote down praise. So it was very clearly forgotten in the original text. And so that would be, a lot of people have actually moved to praise because it seems on its face to make a little bit more sense. But solution three is to kind of work with it, right? Which actually the New King James does. It says they were forgotten in the city. So I think what it seems like is happening here is that these wicked people have lived lives of hypocrisy. They played at worship. They were oppressive. They hurt other people. And yet they lived long lives without receiving any punishment for it. And so they lived, died, were buried, and now they're forgotten. And it seems unjust that the things that they've done that were wicked were just so easily like gone in a generation. Like, where's the justice in just forgetting an offense as great as something like this? Like, think about something, kind of the two easy examples of this are like the Holocaust or like even slavery in America. Like, if we just move past it without even considering it or acknowledging like the weight of the wickedness that happened, then that's hevel. Like, that's not right. But that's what happens a lot of times is wicked people live and die and then they're just forgotten and it's almost like smoothed over, like it never really happened. And he's talking about like the frustration of that that's not how things should be. Like where's their punishment? Who's remembering these things, right? It's kind of what he's getting at. There's so much there. But we'll move on. So verse 11, this kind of describes why this keeps happening. Why is it that people continually being wicked? It's because, well, there's no immediate judgment. And this could be speaking both, I think it's primarily speaking of divine judgment, but could also be human judgment too. Like think of how slow the court systems are, or how many times people get away with things, or sometimes injustice happens, or if you pay the right lawyer, you know you're going to be able to get away with X, Y, Z, right? It's just like it's not working as it should be. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily, the heart of the children of man is fully set to do evil. Like because you're not punished right away, you're like, oh, I can actually get away with this. So I'll keep doing it. Why not? And that's so true of the way that people live is that you look at wicked people. If God, every time somebody sinned, like immediately judged them, one, there would be no people left, right? Because the wages of sin is death. And if we deserve death, then we'd all be dying, right? So the mercy of God actually sets people's hearts to do evil because they think that they're getting away with it. I think this is true even in like parenting, right? If your child thinks like, I broke the rule one time, and what do? Immediately look at mom and dad to see if something bad's going to happen, right? But if eventually they just keep kind of getting away with it, they're like, oh, this is okay. I'm more comfortable with it. So that's what's happening, is that people are more comfortable with evil because there's no immediate condemnation for it. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God, because they fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, neither will he prolong his days like a shadow, because he does not fear before God. This is huge. This is probably one of the two most important verses in this text, is that he has confidence. Solomon returns to expressing faith in God's system of justice, like that what Proverbs says actually is true. It's not, might not always work itself out quite the way that we think it will here, but ultimately, at the end of the day, it is still better to have faith and fear in God, because he's promised that things will go better for you. And that whether you see it or not, again, there, he kind of expresses this like gap between what's actually what you see and what you believe. Like sometimes what you see says, no, it's actually better to be wicked because nothing bad happens to them. He's going to later say time and chance happen to everybody. Like who knows when your time is, or if you're going to receive good for your good. But he trusts, he's still like expressing trust in biblical wisdom, is that it is better to fear God rather than to not. And so we'll say one more thing about that at the end. The next few verses kind of will fly through 14 and 15 because they say things that we've already spoken of at length previously. Verse 14, he describes the same thing we talked about last week. So there's a vanity that takes place on earth, that righteous people sometimes receive what wicked people deserve. And sometimes wicked people receive what righteous people deserve. And there's frustration there. That's all we're really going to say about that. But it's pretty cool poetically. It's actually a chiasm of vanity. It starts and ends with vanity and then says the righteous receive wicked, the wicked receive righteous. It's just a cool poetry. And then again, 15, familiar to us. What's the result? What should we do in light of these things, in light of Hevel? He commends joy. For man has nothing better under the sun but to eat, drink, be joyful. For this will go with him in his toil. So there's still a crescendo. Each time he says this, he's getting a little bit stronger, a little bit louder. We'll talk more about this next week because the most thorough one, I think, happens next week, this kind of recommendation to just enjoy your life. Don't be grim, flustered, critical, sour, right? He says, life is God's gift. And so let joy be your companion through all of your toil. But the frustrating thing here is this gap, right? This gap between what seems right and what Proverbs says and what's actually happening in front of your face. And only wise people are willing to let that gap exist. If you're not willing to let that gap exist, if you need all of the answers to the in-between, then you won't be willing to fear God. You just won't, because you're demanding to know things that only the divine knows. Okay, so we'll wrap it up with 16 through 17. Do you have a running timer, by the way? Okay, we're good. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, how neither day nor night do one's eyes sleep, then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. Okay, again, Solomon's whole his whole person is engaged in this task. So much so that he's just sleepless. Like, he's all in, completely in. And what is he? He's still seeking to know, right? To know. Wisdom, and see how things are working, and then he sees it. This is his discovery. He saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. He says it three times. He cannot find it out. He cannot find it out. He cannot find it out. It doesn't matter how hard you work. It doesn't matter if you never slept another day in your life. It doesn't matter if you spent every penny, every waking hour, every ounce of energy towards finding out the unanswerable questions. You can't answer them. And this is still all like everything that's functioning under the sun, right? This is all things that we see around us. There's this really interesting turn here. His evaluation isn't stopping at evaluating human activity, right? He's also trying to evaluate like God's activity in all of this. And divine activity or inactivity at times doesn't make sense. He's asking questions, but those questions are like fortified so strongly that he has no chance of understanding them. No matter how hard he worked or no matter how many times he like figured or reworked the equation or dreamt about it, no matter how many ways in which he asked the question, he was unable to uncover the answers to why God does what he does, especially as it results to within the realm of human activity, why God acts or doesn't act the way he does in our world. There are works of God that we can never do justice, but they're like crucial to resolving all of this hevel that we encounter. So at the end of the day, no one can comprehend life. No one can answer why to some of the deepest apparent inconsistencies. There are answers to questions that God has locked away in his divine nature. And despite our best efforts to pick the lock, God has chosen not to give men the key. So you have to be willing to let this gap exist. You have to be willing to not have some of the answers. And trust, verses 12 and 13, that it will be well with those who fear God. That it will not be well with the wicked. That God does have divine justice in his hands. And he will work it out well. And we don't need to know the answers. We'll kind of start next week with a few more of these thoughts. But just in like revel in the fact that the crooked things will be made straight. All of the wrongs that have been done, even the wrongs that have been forgotten, will be resolved. All of this critique of God, defamation of his name, slaughter of the unborn, indifference to the needs of the poor or the oppressed, all of these things will be resolved by the divine one who knows the answers to the questions that we desperately want to know. So have faith in him, that he is good and that he'll bring these things to pass.